You're saying you weren't in any danger? I'm never in any danger. Whether an angry mob, what is it, guts me? Whether an angry mob guts me or not? Whether I break my neck in a motorcycle accident or not? Whether all the peoples and nations of the world rise up against me or not? If the universe wants me gutted and dumped in the desert, I'm all for it. And if it doesn't, no mob or government or law of physics is going to make it happen. Those are the fixed and absolute terms of my existence. It's not what I believe. It's just what is. I don't know how to say it any better. She shakes her head in dismay. And this is normal to you? This is life to me, and to you too, now. I set my plate aside and push back a few inches from the table. As you've probably noticed, I'm not a gabby guy. These stories I'm telling you are your new stories. I'm a grown-up in a world where you're just a kid, and I'm telling you these things to help you grow up and make your own stories. The world isn't set up for you now. Wherever you go, you'll be an outsider. There are no families or clans or tribes out there waiting to welcome you and show you around and explain how everything works. There's no apparatus in place to receive you and teach you and protect you. You're going to move beyond the point where anyone can help you because you're an adult now. And this is a children's world. You won't have me, and you probably won't have anyone older than yourself, not even in books. I'm telling you things, making an effort to be a little open and conversational, because you're going to be alone in the world, and it will be very easy for you to just find a rut and stagnate. That could happen. That's practically the only thing that does happen. Everything is set up for that. The world is full of warm, dark holes for you to fall into. I won't have anyone? She asks in a forlorn tone. I won't have you? You'll have yourself. That's all you need. Am I going to do that? Asks Lisa. Go crawling back? Find a hole to hide in? Despite the statistical near certainty of it, I'd guess you won't. I could be wrong. It's not really my thing. But from what I can tell, you're being groomed for something more. You have to try to understand what fear is, or it will get you, and you'll never even know it. We leave the restaurant and go for a stroll along the shoreline. So what ended up happening? She asks. When? With the mob. In Mexico. Oh, nothing. The police chief drove me up to the border and told me never to return to his country. They kicked you out of Mexico? Well, I shrug. It seemed pretty informal. You seem to get into a lot of trouble with the law. I shrug again. No trouble at all. And what did you do after? After he dumped me at the border? Canceled my credit cards. Reported my passport and traveler's checks stolen. Had money wired. They stole your wallet? Sure. Everything I had on me and the knapsack I left in the car. She shakes her head, fed up with petty corruptions. Bastards, she says. Everybody's just playing their role, I say. No reason to take any of it personally. She gives me a long, sideways look. We get back in the Navigator and get back on the road. We drive for an hour in silence, though I sense that it's quite loud inside Lisa's head. I don't think I'll ever look at people the same way again, she says at last. I don't think I'll ever be able to trust anyone again. I watched the changing scenery in silence for a few minutes, happy to be here, happy to be with Lisa, happy to be heading toward Brett's farewell, happy to be. Is this my last day? Are these my last moments? Is death's ever hovering finger about to come down? The thought fills me with a gentle rush of joy and bathes the world in beauty. People are dust bunnies, I finally respond. Little bundles of lint and cobwebs that collect in shadows and dark corners, held together and drawn together by fear. Once you see them clearly, trusting them becomes very easy. I trust everybody, and I'm never disappointed. It can be the same for you. That's very hard to believe. You don't have to trust people not to betray you, or break your heart, or steal your purse. You just trust them to be who they are. Once you understand fear, get a little distance from it, and see what it really is and how it operates in the world, then you can understand everything about people. In an eyes-closed being, everything flows from fear, good and bad. Courage and cowardice, love and hate, all flow from the same well. How can you trust someone who you know will betray you? You answered your own question. Because you know. Everything that's so mysterious and unknowable with eyes closed becomes clear and obvious once we open them. It takes time and experience and effort, just like it took you time and experience and effort to become the adult you are. That's what life is. A process of constant becoming and renewal. A motion toward clearer seeing and greater simplicity and reduction in the perceived division between I and not I. This is the world. This is the way it will be for you if you continue forward. It's a whole different thing. If I continue, she says flatly. When you begin gaining some altitude and see the larger picture, people's personal traits will become a blur, and you start to categorize people by what hole they're hiding in. That sounds a little cynical. Try this on for size. Life has no meaning, and no belief is true. That sounds a lot cynical. My point is that cynical is an eyes-closed word. You don't need it anymore. Your buffered, thought-based relationship to your environment is outmoded, and much of your vocabulary is obsolete. You've made this enormous transition, a true paradigm shift, but your infrastructure hasn't caught up with you yet. You've had your revolution. You've overthrown the oppressive regime, and now it's time to govern. To rule wisely and to lead this newly emerged island nation into a future of growth and prosperity. You have others to think about. Maggie and DJ, and maybe Dennis. Maybe others as well. You were a wife and a mother before. What are you now? Maggie's at a critical age, and she's had quite an unusual ride already. Watching your meltdown, working with her grandfather, interrogating me. What are you going to do with her? Maybe I should find a hole, she says glumly. Go find Jesus. Maybe that would be best for everyone. I nod. Maybe so. Thank you for talking, she says. Thank you for telling me things. De nada. I can't believe how my life has changed. Look at me, here with you, off on this bizarre adventure, whatever it is. It's completely surreal. I feel like I'm going to wake up in my old bed next to Dennis, turning off the alarm and starting a new day and forgetting all about this crazy dream of a new life. She gets a little shaky. What am I doing here? Why do you think you're here? I ask her. Step back from events and ask yourself impartially what's going on. A few months ago, you're a lawyer and a wife and a suburban mom and all that. And now here you are driving this big black hearse across Virginia with Jed McKenna, she supplies, with one awakened being on the way to eulogizing another. This would be a very good time for you to reflect on what's going on and why. She's quiet for a few moments. Do you know? She asks. I know for me. Do you know what you're going to say at the eulogy? In the broad strokes, Maggie gave me the idea of show and tell. So that's what I'm going to do. Really? What are you going to show? Two things. One, as you know, we're hoping to find waiting for us in the hotel safe. And the other, what else are you going to show? I reach into my pack on the floor behind her seat. I pull out her day planner, and I set it on the console between us. You. Chapter 26, Post-Uterine Gestation. Magnifying and applying come I, outbidding at the start the old cautious hucksters, taking myself the exact dimensions of Jehovah, lithographing Kronos, Zeus his son, and Hercules his grandson, buying drafts of Osiris, Isis, Belus, Brahma, Buddha, in my portfolio placing Manito loose, Allah on a leaf, the crucifix engraved with Odin and the hideous-faced Mehitli, and every idol and image, taking them for what they are worth and not a cent more, admitting they were alive and did the work of their days. They bore mites as for unfledged birds, who have now to rise and fly and sing for themselves. Walt Whitman. Lisa gets us pleasantly lost. We're in no hurry, so she maintains the correct general heading, and whenever there's a choice, she takes the road less traveled. We've meandered along this way for nearly 200 miles. Now it's getting late in the day, and we're both a little tired of driving. So we stop in a small river town to find a place for dinner and a hotel with a couple of rooms. Lisa wasn't happy to be told that she'd be speaking to the group at Brett's place. She actually refused on the basis that she had no knowledge or understanding of spiritual matters, and was therefore an inappropriate choice to address a group of dedicated spiritual aspirants. I pointed out that, in her short journey, she had already gone far beyond them all. But she was still adamant that she would not address the group. I understand that you won't do it, I tell her, but I'm pretty sure you will. It's simply the pattern. There to be seen. She finds a nice old hotel and we park, but neither of us is very hungry, so we decide to stretch our legs and check out the town. How does it feel to be an orphan? I ask her. God, I hadn't thought of it that way, she laughs. I'm an orphan. What a strange thing to say, like I'm married. Or I'm not a virgin anymore. Maybe it's not so much a new status as a non-status. I'm not sure it feels that way, I'm not sure how it feels. Not to be insensitive, but you might want to take a moment to appreciate the way the universe is accommodating this transition of yours. It's pretty impressive. I don't know if it's very clear to you right now, but the way your past is being picked up and your future is being laid down. You're right, she says abruptly. It's not very clear to me. I guess it's more clear to you. I take that as a grudging invitation to continue. All forces are being steadily employed to complete and delight you, to borrow from Whitman. It's you who set all this in motion. You demonstrated clear intent, not merely through words or ideas, but through actions. When we do this, the universe naturally becomes more pliable than our usual experience of it. It starts reshaping itself to us, and we to it. This is what happens as the perceived division between self and non-self begins to erode. That's what's happening with you. And this much more responsive, pliable universe is your new reality. It sounds like you're saying my parents are dead because of the situation I'm in. Are you saying that if you weren't in this situation, your parents wouldn't have died? I don't know, she answers after a pause. I don't know either. I just know what I can see from the outside looking in. And that's that here in your first stages of life as an integrated being, you're getting the star treatment. Massive quantities of biographical baggage whisked away, having me around. Your future life of ease and comfort and continued growth being laid out for you like a royal banquet. A royal banquet? She asks with a trace of bitterness. No waitressing in Corpus Christi with big hair and a fat ass, I explain. No damage to your credit rating, should you still care. You're in for a nice little inheritance, from what your father said. We walk in silence for a while. I feel an unusual urge to meddle. Lisa's not going to have me around much longer, and it would be nice to scoot her through this uncomfortable teething stage and get her to a point where she can fend for herself a bit. It's hard to believe, but most people who go as far as she's gone dig in and refuse to go further. They curl up in a fetal pose, scrunch their eyes closed, and live in the world as if they were still in the womb. It sounds too weird to be true. But among those who make the death-rebirth transition, it's so common as to be the norm. I wouldn't like to see Lisa stop before she starts. I usually don't invest myself, not because I have a rule about it, but because I feel no urge. But now I do, so I do. I'm going to tell you what you need to hear, even though you didn't ask. You've had your death and birth, and you've experienced major changes and losses. But now that part is over, and it's time for you to open your eyes and start getting things figured out. It's a whole new world, and you're a whole new being. This is what it's all been about since that picture first stabbed you in the heart. All this pain and suffering and loss. The wrenching decisions, the personal betrayals, it was all leading to this. That part is over now. You're not that person anymore. Now you have to let it all go and move forward, or else it was all for nothing. She stops abruptly, pissed, I imagine. I keep walking. I head off into the surrounding neighborhoods, wishing I had my dog with me. Think of a man who loses his job and sinks into despair because he personally identified with his work to such a degree that loss of job means loss of self or loss of manhood. Think of a woman who undergoes a similar crisis of identity due to divorce, with the attendant loss of her primary identity structure. Think of parents whose lives lose all meaning due to the loss of a child, or someone who's lost all hope and joy due to some bad news from the doctor. Losses like these can make us feel like we've lost our core. We might feel we can't recover from them, and maybe we can't. When we believe in the world outside of ourselves, gain is often perceived as good and loss as bad. When we stop believing in a world external to self, that reverses. Gain becomes bad and loss becomes good. Nothing we can lose was ever ours in the first place. All we can ever lose is illusion. Using the movie Joe versus the Volcano as our parallel, Lisa has managed to make the transition from a mindless drone shuffling through a life of programmed drudgery to a vibrant and aware being charting a course away from the things of man. As in Joe, the universe has gone to seemingly supernatural lengths to accommodate her transition. She could never have wished for such cataclysmic upheaval in her life any more than Joe Banks could have wished for a prognosis of a brain cloud with a life expectancy of a few months. Looking back, however, neither would change a thing. Emerson said a man is what he thinks about all day long. Buddha supposedly said something similar. But any time you see the words Buddha said, your bullshit alarm should start screeching. So we'll stick with Emerson. I don't seem to think about anything anymore. I can't even think of anything that needs thinking about. Sometimes I try to think about something, latch on to something, and give it some thought, but it just fades after a moment or two. Thought for me is a tool, a weapon. The only reason to lug it out is if something needs to be killed. It's a sword, but I have nothing left to swing it at. I pick it up desultorily and cleave the air, but it's just the empty reminiscences of an old soldier. What would I think about? Religion? Politics? Business? The arts? I am blank. I am, by Emerson's reckoning, nothing. My general state most closely resembles a kind of bittersweet gladness. I don't dwell in my memories. I'm not even sure if I really have any. It seems like I have a box of old Super 8 footage somewhere in my mental space. But the idea of hauling it out and reminiscing over the clumsily spliced scenes of a life with which I feel no connection holds no appeal. I know that I was once a warrior, but it's not the memory of that state of being, just the recollection of a fact. There's no pleasure or displeasure in it. It's like something you know about someone else. Once in a while, I climb up into the belfry and look around for bats. I head into my head to make sure that there are no messes anywhere, no pockets of darkness, no tracks in the dust, no piles of droppings. Like an old unarmed night watchman making his rounds, I do a quick tour of the joint. I don't do it in a very alert or cautious manner. I'm not too concerned that there would be anything to find, or, if there was, that removal would pose any great challenge. Death especially is an area where I want to remain a bit vigilant. I don't feel any fear or concern about my death. I don't attach any importance to it, but it seems like the kind of thing that could sneak something past me. So I keep an eye out. I've been in a dozen situations in the last decade where I figured it was all over, and never were there any unpleasant surprises about my reaction. In every situation, I felt intrigued, ready, grateful. I didn't panic or react fearfully, so I'm reasonably sure that I don't have much in the way of death demons lurking about. It would be interesting if I did, but I don't think I do. Refusing the fat sergeant's invitation is something I find curious in this regard. It's not that I'm sorry I didn't turn around and yell, "Boo!" It's that I'm not sure why I didn't. I'm not concerned about it, just curious. You don't get an offer like that every day, so it seems appropriate to review your response. My day-to-day persona is another thing I keep a lazy sort of awareness about. I interact. I have a presence in the lives of other people, and I have my own life to navigate through, my dream state existence. That's something I pay attention to, but again, not much. It doesn't take much thought or effort. I have this teacher-author thing going, but there's no real danger of that pulling me back down into the perinatal states commonly mistaken for waking life. I don't think anything could pull me back down. But there's no harm in this minimal sort of mindfulness. A lot of it comes down to the books. I have a very enjoyable interest right now in Orwell's 1984, for instance. But if it weren't for the context provided by the writing of the third book, I wouldn't have a care for it. It's of no interest to me personally because there is no personal me to be interested. The time I spent in Frank's library and listening to his encyclopedic knowledge on the methods of transcendence used by various cultures through the ages, and his views on a dystopian corporate world state, is the same way. It was interesting insofar as it served the book, but beyond that, nothing. I have no genuine, independent interest in anything except going for walks, preferably with my dog. This is what it is to be fully awake, enlightened, truth realized. That is what it would be for anyone. A Buddha of compassion, for example, is an oxymoron, an irreconcilable contradiction. It sounds nice, but it's a complete absurdity, as anyone who has worked through the theory part of this subject can easily see for themselves. It amuses me to think that there are people in the world who consider the truth-realized state something to be devoutly wished for and fought for. The contradictions start piling up immediately. It can't be wished for because there's no it, nor an I to inhabit it. And yet I, who reside in this state, wouldn't trade it for any amount of wealth or power or beauty or kids or grandkids, or anything else. I want to shy away from marketing buzzwords like bliss or love because I don't feel they accurately describe this state, at least not as these terms are understood by those not in it. I am happy, content, usually either amused or cheerfully engaged, and yet, if I were to receive a message informing me that my death would occur in exactly 5 minutes, I would have no reaction except to clear my mind and shift my attention to what a nice time I've had here and allow my gratitude to well up and engulf me. Maybe that was the missing piece when the sergeant made his offer. I wouldn't have had the chance to Say thank you and goodbye to this fun, lovely, challenging existence. Slipping out the back door like that might have had an irresistible comic charm, but it would have left this large reservoir of gratitude unreleased. That would have made for a poor death, and that twinge of regret would have been the second-to-last thing to go through my mind. That's what I decide as I stroll around the little town in Virginia. When it's time to go, I'd like a minute or two to say goodbye first. I set my desire on that wish and release it, confident that it will, when the time comes, be granted. Lisa and I get back together an hour later and make our way to the hotel restaurant's outdoor dining area. We settle in and order iced teas and look out over the water. I don't think people can simply make their past go away as if it wasn't there, she says, picking up from our last exchange, as if it wasn't a part of them. The drinks come, and we order. You don't make your past go away, I tell her. It just fades away, like when you wake up in the morning. The dream world in which you were just immersed fades away and is forgotten. When this happens, we know directly, see for ourselves, without intermediary people or processes. For the rest of your life, you'll look at the person you were and virtually everyone else as inferior and defective. Inferior and defective, she repeats with distaste. Inferior in the developmental sense that a child is inferior to an adult, and defective in the sense that developmental stagnation is abnormal. What else would you say about a creature that grows and develops into physical adulthood without ever exiting the womb? She makes an expression of distaste. That's gross, she says. That's another thing you can expect to change, I say. That egoic need to judge and categorize and label everything. That will fade as otherness gives way to isness. It's a much more relaxed, low-maintenance perspective. Isn't that what intelligence is for? She asks. Judging? Weighing? Determining value and worth? Am I supposed to just relinquish my powers of discrimination? That doesn't sound right to me. What you call intelligence is the intelligence of rats in a maze, of chimps stacking blocks to get to the higher bananas. Once you see the real intelligence at work in all things, at all times, you'll never think of it in human terms again. Thought, as you understand it, as a tool of navigation and understanding, is just another non-necessity that gets dropped and forgotten. All of our opinions are just mini-beliefs, rubbish we haul around with us at the expense of our life energy. Your tendency to judge things as good or bad, right or wrong, and so forth, just naturally falls away, and that energy is freed up. You'll soon begin to find all opinions and beliefs rather noxious, and you'll naturally tend away from their source, which is ego. I can't imagine, she says, sipping her iced tea while I dig around in my Caesar salad, looking for signs of Caesar. Iceberg lettuce, tomato wedges, orange cheese, and mystery dressing from a can. The only ingredients that belongs on this plate are the croutons, and they're chewy. You seem to be judging your salad, she observes wryly. Are you not content with its isness? I laugh. I have likes and dislikes, personal preferences, things that please me and displease me. No one's talking about acting a certain way or trying to adapt to some preconceived notions of how you should be. That's a trap, and a very effective one, judging from the number of people in it. I don't see you falling into many traps, she says. We're not talking about me, I say. She sighs heavily. Why are we having this conversation, may I ask? Because I want to make you uncomfortable, I say. I want to irritate and annoy you. You're succeeding. What's the context in which this conversation is taking place? Meaning? What are we doing, I ask. What are you doing? I'm delivering you so you can deliver Brett's eulogy, I thought. No. My context is the book. I'm writing a book. What's yours? She shakes her head. I don't know. I guess I haven't thought about it. You don't have to think, I say. You just have to look. We eat an uninspired meal, and they take away our plates. We turn our chairs to the view and sip our iced teas. It's a few minutes before she speaks again. I don't know how not to distinguish good from bad and right from wrong, she says after the long interval. How do you not judge? It's like I'd be forfeiting my intellect, my personal sovereignty, my moral compass. How can you do that? This is a tricky question to answer because it would be so easy to over-answer. I like to help people take their next step and to gently discourage them from looking beyond it. In Damnedest, there was a brief dialogue between me and Maya, the architect of delusion, not the dog. I'd remarked on her beauty, and she asked if I would prefer her other face, and I said either was fine. That playful exchange concealed all the horror and evil and suffering in the world. Maya's other face. I am awake from the dream state, so I can no longer be fooled by either face, not good or evil, not beauty or horror. I know it all for what it is, that it's all one thing. It's not necessary or even possible to show Lisa at this stage that there's no difference between any two extremes. But it is time she started to rethink her deep-rooted belief that there is. She doesn't have to see Maya's other face to take the next step, but she does have to start questioning her practice of sorting the world into piles like laundry. Yes, we're going to deliver Brett's eulogy, but that's not our context. My context is this book, and Lisa's context is that of a crawling infant, to start moving around and interacting with her environment, to figure out where she is and how things work, and how she fits into it all. Trees grow weak in biospheres because there's no wind for them to contend against. Artificial wind is generated to let the trees develop their strength, not to be cruel, not to bully them. Spare the wind, spoil the tree. I watched a young girl on television, I tell Lisa as we stroll a wooded bike trail a little later. She's undergone this horrendous tragedy. She's been trapped in a burning car, I think, and sustained more damage than you'd imagine a body could. She's been through many surgeries, but her disfiguration was virtually total. At one point during the interview, she looked at the nubs where her fingers had been and said, "I used to cry when I broke a nail." It's a moment before Lisa responds, her voice a whisper. "My God. That's so horrible." "Is it?" I reply. "I thought it was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever heard. What poem could compare? What art? War and disaster photography is the only thing I know that comes close. But that doesn't compare with the image of a real, live girl, once a pretty little high school kid full of hopes and dreams, but now as physically ruined as it's possible to be, looking at her ravaged hands and saying, "I used to cry when I broke a nail." "You have a very peculiar idea of beauty," says Lisa sourly. "That poor girl. Her poor family." To me, it wasn't about the girl. It was about me, about life, about being. This is where we are. These are the rules. That dead body, receiving a Y incision on a stainless steel table tomorrow morning, is me. That woman plummeting from the World Trade Center is you. That burned girl is Maggie. Lisa stops and turns to face me. I stop, too. She has a very level and steady gaze that's hard to read, but I don't have to read it. I speak my next words slowly and clearly. "Do you know where you are?" "Nothing." "Miras, abrace los ojos." "Please don't, Jed," she says. "I know you're trying to help me somehow, but it's such a nice evening. Can't we just relax and enjoy it?" Too much? Am I pushing Lisa too hard? I could go into any library or bookstore and fill boxes with books from the poetry, religious, spirituality, self-help, and philosophy sections written by people who made it as far as Lisa is now and never an inch further. People who have undergone the death-rebirth transition, but stayed in their eyes closed, imagined reality instead of opening their eyes to the new world into which they've emerged. I wouldn't have thought it possible, but I see it all the time. It seems that once we were set in motion, we would stay in motion, but this is plainly not so. The same fierce determination to stay rooted in place we exhibit while in the womb, we continue to exhibit after we emerge. When we cross-reference the metaphors against each other and index the observable cases, we discover an intermediary stage between two worlds, a sort of hypnagogic, purgatorial state in which a person has left the womb but still calls it home, in which they have entered the world but not yet opened their eyes. This is not the same thing as the faux rebirth so common in pop Christianity and 12-step programs. These are people who have truly made the transition out of the womb, but not beyond the grip of fear. Nor is it simply the removal of one's chains in Plato's cave. It's undeniably more than that, but undeniably less than lucid. It seems almost unnatural, but as people who go in for freaky sex assure us, the only unnatural act is the one you can't perform. So we have to look at these in-between states as rungs on the evolutionary ladder out of the subterranean levels of dark consciousness in which mankind crouches in self-imposed damnation. And that's where Lisa is now. Emerged from the darkness, but eyes still closed. And that's how she could stay, between two worlds, an alien in both. It would be easy for her to mistake this starting point as a final destination and put down stakes, maybe even put out a shingle once she figures out how she got here, write a book, give talks, make a career of aiding others through an incomplete transition. The temptation to rest must be great after the struggle it takes to get this far, but I'm eager that Lisa should keep going. Maybe that's what that delivery room slap on the ass is for. Maybe that's what I'm trying to do for Lisa. The next thing she has to do isn't easy, but it's not that hard either. And if she can do it, then she can go and keep going. I feel like it would be quite a shame for Lisa to have made it this far and to go no further. This is where it starts getting good. I don't have a lot of experience of working with people at this stage, but what I do know is that I should be encouraging Lisa not to get too comfortable just yet, even if it means pissing her off a bit. We walk in silence for 10 minutes before I start in on her again. You lived 30-some-odd years in your life in the womb, born of the flesh but unborn of the spirit, I say. Who wants to leave the womb? No one. Regardless of what they say, no one wants out. You can't. It's warm and comfortable and safe in there. And to leave means the end of the world, the end of the only life you've ever known. The only way anyone gets out of there is if some sort of disaster or toxicity drives them screaming out into the world. Which is what I went through, she muses, like a gradual toxification that eventually became unbearable. Yes, and now here you are. But you still want to deny and reject all that's not pleasing and nice. That's the old way, the eyes closed way. Now it's time to look, to see everything, to behold the creation of which you are a part. That's what honesty is. That's what living with eyes open is. Acceptance of what is. Acknowledging where you are and what the rules are. Seeing how it works. How to participate. How to live without fear. This is all so dark and depressing, she says. It's not that it's dark, I continue. It's that you're squinting. It's okay to look. It only seems dark because you don't look at it, don't go into it. But we can. You can. We wall off all the bad, scary stuff because that's what children do. They shut their eyes real tight so they don't have to see the monsters. This is a children's world, and it's full of reward and punishment religions and pick-and-choose spiritual systems that embrace the pleasant and pretty while excluding the dark and ugly. But the only reason for that is fear. When you open your eyes and see where you are, you see everything, and only then is fear vanquished. Right now, you're still living in your imagined realm. You're not a part of that anymore. But you haven't moved on yet either. It's time to open your eyes, to see where you are. She lowers her head. So much for a nice evening, she says. Long enough have you dreamed contemptible dreams, I quote Whitman again. Now I wash the gum from your eyes. You must habit yourself to the dazzle of the light and of every moment of your life. I'm getting a lot of Whitman today, she observes. Whitman, at his best, is all about where you are now, all about this transition, this rebirth. She looks over at me. Really? You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, I recite. Nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. That's Whitman. Most mystical poetry, when it's not just flowery gibberish, is about the two elements of the death-rebirth process. leaving the segregated state and entering the integrated state. Not enlightenment? I chuckled at the thought of it. No, there's no art depicting non-dual awareness or poetry celebrating the truth-realized state or anything like that. It's not that kind of thing. Well, Whitman sounds nicer than the story of that poor little girl. But it's not a time for nice. Here's something from my own experience, a little aha event. I was in school in New York in the early 80s. One day, a news radio station was on. Standard news items, the kind of stuff you only half hear, and then after something about the mayor, and before something about the Yankees, in the same mechanical tone, the announcer says, "A man broke into a Upper West Side apartment today and threw a baby against the wall for no apparent reason." "Oh, Jesus," she says, hands over her mouth. "Please, Shed, no more. Let's just walk. Please?" I've always thought of that as the perfect haiku. Despite its form violations, I call it Fuck Basho's Frog. A man broke in to a West Side apartment today and threw a baby against the wall for no apparent reason. Plop. Even much later, as I edit this chapter beside another pool in another part of Mexico, I don't know whether this material will go into the book. Is it too dark? Fingerless girl? Baby thrown against a wall? Does it serve the book or detract? The answer, as I well know, is that it's not for me to decide. I am unclear, and clarity will come. I need only be patient, and the answer will appear. The universe will make itself known. I wasn't trying to shock Lisa for the sake of shocking her. If I just wanted to be shocking, I suppose I could have hit her with some truly high-voltage horror and really fried her circuits. My thought was to deliver a few light zaps to her heart, just enough to make her aware of this whole area she kept dark and walled off. That's what I'm idly musing when this New York Times headline appears on my laptop. Man stabs baby girl in her stroller. The universe has made itself known. The material goes in. One final note. On the night of what would have been my final edit of this chapter, I was reading something unrelated to any of this, and I came across the term post-uterine gestation. I've been struggling with this whole concept of people getting just as stuck after their emergence as they were before it, and from the most unlikely of sources, an essay on Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. I was provided with this term, post-uterine gestation, and it seemed to capture this bizarre phenomenon we've been looking at in these pages. This term suggests, as my observations have found, that emergence into the world is not the clear, formative demarcation point one would naturally assume. The processes of growth and development that are at work before and during this emergence are still at work after. And if we abort these processes, or fail to recognize and nurture them, we are likely to entomb ourselves outside the womb as effectively as those still in it. Weird. Chapter 27. Casus Belli. Yet now, forsooth, because Pierre began to see through the first superficiality of the world, he fondly weens he has come to the unlayered substance. But far as any geologist has yet gone down into the world, It is found to consist of nothing but surface, stratified on surface. To its axis, the world being nothing but superinduced superficies. By vast pains we mine into the pyramid. By horrible gropings we come to the central room. With joy we espy the sarcophagus, but we lift the lid, and no body is there. Appallingly vacant, as vast is the soul of a man. Herman Melville, Pierre. As we drove, Lisa told me about her husband, Dennis. Dennis was a dentist. Dennis the dentist. She told me he secretly hated being a dentist, or maybe he just hated being Dennis. She wasn't sure. He became a dentist because that's what his father was. He was so desperate to please his parents, she said, that his life was a constant losing struggle to live up to their expectations and win their approval. Lisa said he hated a lot of things about his life, so he was never happy and often angry. He suffered from depression and alcoholism, though to outward appearances he seemed happy and successful. Projecting that image, especially to his parents, was the driving motivation of his life. Our relationship to our parents is a very important thing to look at, not because we want to heal the relationship and any wounds we may have suffered or inflicted, but because most of us are still stuck at that level. If our basic understanding of life is similar in the broad outlines to that of our parents, then we have not yet begun our own journey. We are the children of children, who are the children of children, who were the children of children, and so on, all the way back. Quite a chain to break. But breaking chains is what liberation is all about. Anyone who ever wants to do anything in life, to become a person in their own right, must begin by killing their parents, metaphorically. When we kill our parents, what we're really doing is sloughing off the inmost layer of false context in which we are encased and by which we are defined. That's what we're doing any time we take a step, sloughing off the next layer of enshrouding delusion. We'll see another variation of this theme when we look at Brett's past and her relationship with her father and how she dealt with it. Dennis, according to Lisa, hasn't dealt with it. Maybe he will. Maybe he'll go into counseling and talk it out or have a primal scream or take some MDMA in a therapeutic setting and have a cathartic healing event that lets him finally move beyond this spiritual constipation that has rendered him a perpetual and chronically ill child. Cathartic means purgative, as in purge, as in evacuating a toxin or obstruction, as in taking a massive mental emotional dump and restoring free flow system-wide. All progress can be understood as a matter of flow and obstruction. Lisa, after suffering a prolonged illness, finally managed to have her own cathartic, purgative healing event. And we can see where that got her, so far anyway. She lost all of her primary definitions. Maybe she would have preferred to just take a pill and make the pain go away so she could remain in her life circumstances. There are many such pills, and they take many different forms. But she didn't take a pill. She took the pain. He has a morbid fixation on pleasing his parents, so they'll be proud of him, she told me of Dennis. But they're never pleased. Nothing he does is good enough. So he keeps trying to do more, and he just makes himself crazy. He's still just a little boy to them. I don't think I ever realized it before, but it's like a sickness with him. And a lot of his problems are like symptoms. Drinking, high achievement and low self-esteem, chronic unhappiness, always dissatisfied, always pretending he's happy and successful, and all because he's so eager to please his parents, which he'll never do, because they're never impressed by anything. No matter what he does, he's trapped. Even after they're dead, they'll still have this hold over him. There's no way out for him. The unexamined life, said Socrates, is not worth living. That's some serious shit. Most people wouldn't want to examine that statement, much less their own lives. If we take it to mean the stagnated, entrenched life is not worth living, then we are saying that most people's lives aren't worth the bother, which is pretty much how human childhood looks from the perspective of human adulthood. You can still make a case for human childhood, but it has that dissatisfying feel of winning on a technicality. Socrates makes quite a damning indictment. The unexamined life is not worth living. Who lives a conscious, examined life? Everyone probably thinks they do, but virtually no one actually does. Who decides to spend the hours and days and weeks and months and years of their life as they do? Who, by conscious decision, with informed thought aforethought, decides to pair up and have kids and buy a house and work a job and spend the very coin of their life filling in the lines of a hand-me-down coloring book life? Where are the people living examined lives? Lives worth living? Where are the people who made a choice? Not just the secondary choices made within an unchosen framework, but the principal choices. The choice of the framework itself. Where are the people who chose their lives? Who consciously chooses to wrap themselves in chains? Who chooses marriage and children and career? Who chooses to join the ranks of debt-ridden consumers and spend the fruits of their lifelong labors as a slave to possessions and corporations? Who chooses to spend their free time running errands and doing chores and watching television? Who chooses to eat toxic foods, to live in toxic environments, surrounded by toxic people? Who chooses to live a pre-programmed life from birth to death? Who dreams such sordid, vile, life-negative dreams? Sure, maybe a life of drudgery and carrot chasing is exactly what we'd choose if we did choose. But we don't. That's what it means to be unconscious, to be asleep within the dream. We slip into the lives that are laid out for us the way children slip into the clothes their mother lays out for them in the morning. No one decides. We don't live our lives by choice, but by default. We play the roles we are born to. We don't live our lives. We dispose of them. We throw them away because we don't know any better. And the reason we don't know any better is because we never asked. We never questioned or doubted, never stood up, never drew a line. We never walked up to our parents or our spiritual advisors, or our teachers, or any of the other formative presences in our early lives and asked one simple, honest, straightforward question. The one question that must be answered before any other question can be asked. What the hell is going on here? That's how you kill them. Not with guns and machetes, but with thought and honesty and directness. That's how you look, how you see. That's how you draw a line. This isn't a peppy little halftime speech meant to whip us all into a carpe diem frenzy and send us screaming out into the field with victory in our hearts and a life positive, freedom-loving, first day of the rest of your life, bloodlust pumping through our veins until the alarm blares Monday morning and sends us shuffling back to prison routine. Seizing the day just ain't gonna cut it. That's like encouraging an inmate to pursue their lifelong dream of singing in the prison choir. If I had a son or daughter, someone for whom I cared deeply, I would encourage them instead with the words, carpe vitae, seize your life. And if I knew the Latin word for fucking, I'd stick that in there too. I'd tattoo it on the backs of their hands, so they had to look at it all the time and feel a healthy shame and self-loathing for every minute they pissed away as a spectator instead of a player. Speaking metaphorically, the first thing we must do in our bid for freedom is to kill our parents. We kill the Buddha, or equivalent, last on the way to truth realization, but we kill our parents first on the way to anywhere. There are a whole lot more people who need killing before freedom is achieved. But that's how it must begin. Until we kill our parents, metaphorically, we remain unborn. That's what the movie The Graduate is about. The death and rebirth of Benjamin Braddock as he smashes out of his life, killing his parents, their world, their hopes for him, their society, the person they had molded him into, and the future for which they were fitting him, and struggling through his own self-birth process. There are no good guys or bad guys in The Graduate. The parents aren't evil, just vapid. And there's no law against being vapid, or we'd all be locked up. Rather, there is, and we are. Elaine exhibits no will and is just a prize to be won or lost. At the end of the film, she has not been set free. She has merely had her pattern disrupted. Ultimately, the movie is about the time bombs among us. Ben didn't want to explode and ruin everything around him. He didn't do all that hard work at school while plotting his escape. He is as much a victim of his own spontaneous detonation as anyone. The Graduate is not about love. It's about breaking away.